Hello, bonjour, entente. I'm Paula Simons, and this is Alberta Unbound. Ever since Alberta Premier Danielle Smith announced her intention to bring in a wide-ranging suite of policies to limit the civil rights and privacy rights of trans youths and trans adults, I've been bothered. And it's not simply because I oppose those policies. It's because I've seen so many people, even Albertans who aren't usually Danielle Smith fans, either embracing her anti-trans rhetoric or staying strangely quiet. And I've been asking myself, what is it about this issue, about trans kids and trans rights, that makes so many Albertans so uncomfortable? For the rest of us, what can we do to protect trans kids in this moment, when their very personal struggles are being weaponized as a political wedge issue? So I asked two great Albertans to help me grapple with these questions. Alex Marshall works for the University of Alberta's College of Health Science, where she is the college's Strategic Initiatives Officer for Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion. She grew up in Joffre, Alberta, and before joining the U of A, she spent years working in rural Alberta schools, speaking on LGBTQ+ issues. Christy Harcourt is a social worker and therapist who devotes much of her practice to counseling trans kids and their families. She is a social work instructor at McEwen University, the organizer of Edmonton's annual Queer Prom, a longtime gay rights activist, and perhaps most relevantly for me, one of my favorite cousins. Here's our conversation. Since these days, names and pronouns and labels are creating so much furor, I want to ask you each, how do you define and identify yourselves? Alex, let's start with you.
Sure. My name is Alex. My pronouns are she, her. I'm a transgender woman, born and raised, like you said, in Joffre, Alberta. Very, very tiny, not even town, about 123 people now. That's where I grew up. My parents still live there, so still get to go back and visit fairly frequently. Went to school in Lacombe, the big city at the time to me, and live here in Edmonton now, where I do a lot of the work that I do.
And Christy?
Yeah, I am Christy Harcourt, she, her pronouns. I'm a queer lesbian woman, a cisgender woman. I grew up here in Edmonton. And I've been sort of out and involved in queer community organizing in Edmonton for 30 years.
There is such rampant transphobia out there. Some of it straight up hateful, some of it camouflaged by a kind of performative expressing concerns about caring for children. I want to ask each of you, what's the first thing you want to tell people, especially parents, who seem so afraid, so worried about the recognition of trans kids? Alex, let's start with you.
What I'm generally finding is just a discomfort. It's very similar to what we've seen in any form of, you know, those kind of historical discrimination pieces. When people are encountering something new and different, I think it's a very natural human emotion to have a little bit of hesitancy and a little bit of discomfort with something new and very different, particularly when we think about societally as we've grown up, like what are the narratives we've been told about gender and sexuality. I think one of the reasons that we see primarily this kind of rhetoric focusing on trans women is just the way that our culture is very, very sensitive and protective around masculinity in particular. And so, like, we feel very uncomfortable with any violations of that. It's a very, very sensitive piece. So the idea of trans women, who a lot of these folks view and discuss as men, engaging in femininity for them is deeply uncomfortable. And so I think, like, that's one piece that informs it. And then when we have a culture around it that gives people the permission to be hateful in that way, I think that just kind of expresses in that kind of fashion.
And Christy, what do you think?
I sort of want a caveat to say that there are also many, many supportive parents completely behind their kids and completely behind kids. That's the world that I often see. And so I want to name that. But I think letting people know that that we are more diverse than we were taught. I think, you know, what I thought the diversity of the world was when I took biology or when I took, you know, high school science, now working in clinical practice and doing sex therapy and learning about the world, I've learned that, you know, that we are just so much more diverse than that. And that actually our difference is beautiful, that the diversity among us is beautiful, and that it's wonderful when people can figure out what is true for them and express what is true for them and live the lives that they were meant to lead. What a beautiful thing, and what an interesting idea that we would try to limit it.
Yeah. Alex, as you mentioned, you grew up in Joffrey, which is a little hamlet in Lacombe County with a big gas plant. When did you realize that you might be trans, and what was it like coming of age in rural Alberta with that in the back of your mind, or maybe the front of your mind? I don't know.
Yeah, it's such a interesting and difficult question. I was actually talking about this with a friend a little bit ago about how one of the saddest things about the narrative as it is right now is that it limits the ability to have these kind of conversations, because I know a lot of trans folks who just don't feel comfortable talking about this topic, and not because it isn't interesting and cool and fascinating. As Christy said, like part of that wonderful, beautiful diversity of humans, it's because as we're trying to understand these things, it's so easy for it to be weaponized when a person talks about trying to understand themselves, because it's by nature kind of a messy process. But to answer your question, like it's so hard to answer because without the language to talk about it,
yeah,
you only have your own perspective. And so understanding yourself as different is very difficult sometimes because you're the only reference point you have. So kind of the example I give is like growing up, I just kind of assumed for a really long time that everybody felt the way that I felt because I didn't have a language to understand myself as different necessarily. I just kind of understood it as a way of being that you're not supposed to talk about, that kind of the initial pieces that I remember of my transness, as I can label it now, were things that I expressed and put out there that very immediately got pushback, or I had those like subtle clues of like how not to be. You know, kids are sponges of how to behave socially in the environments that they're in. And so as I kind of was growing up and expressing myself and saying the things that kind of just felt natural and right to me, the adults in my life and the people around me were kind of rejecting that or pushing back on that, or in some subtle way indicating that they were uncomfortable with that. And so kind of quickly I learned like, oh, you're not supposed to talk about that. You're not supposed to show that. But it's hard to understand yourself as different sometimes. And so I was like, oh, everybody feels this way. You just don't talk about it. It's one of those private things that for whatever reason our society has determined is not supposed to be expressed. So for a good deal of my youth, I kind of just like wandered around assuming that that's how everybody felt. And then later on, I started to get like a better sense of that as you kind of come to conceptualize yourself more fully. I was like, okay, no, maybe other folks don't feel this way. And so I just kind of didn't, again, have a language to describe that. I didn't see a path forward in that of how to understand or live in the world differently. It wasn't until university when I, you know, moved up to Edmonton, found out about like groups for folks such as myself, that I had the opportunity to go and meet other people who understood themselves as trans. This was in, you know, the early 2000s kind of time frame. So there was no conversation around trans acceptance. There was no language to talk about trans liberation or freedom or the ability to live as yourself safely. So generally, the way I tell folks about like my understanding of living as a trans person back then was informed by the people I met, who I broadly fell into three camps. The folks who were coming there who were trans, who were like, I can't ever tell anybody else that or express that in any way. I come to this meeting to just like get that out there. That's why I do this. The folks who did transition, who generally really suffered for that, primarily, you know, folks who lost their job or, you know, had to engage in survival sex work even, to just live as themselves. And then another group of people who came out after retirement, basically folks who were older, wow, who said, basically, I always knew I thought, oh, now I'm retired. I have my pension. My kids are out of the house. I get to spend my twilight years being myself. And I generally kind of understood that as my life path. I was in education at the time, looking to be a teacher. And I knew there was zero chance of coming out as trans and being a teacher in early 2000s Alberta. That just wasn't even a discussion that could have happened. So, I knew that if I had come out at that time, there's just no real way for me to live in society, as it were. And so I kind of thought that would probably be me at some point. So I was pleasantly surprised in 2017 when Bill C-16 passed and I had protections to come out and be myself. And so that was kind of the trajectory that my life took for coming out.
Well, it's a really important thing to remember because, I'm fretting about the backlash, and the backlash is real. But the backlash is only a function of all the success and all the revolutionary, liberation that happened. I mean, that's one of the reasons people are so angry now is because there was forward progress. So Christy, when you're working with parents and families who are having these conversations, when parents come to you, what sort of questions and concerns do they have? Because I can imagine, even if they're really supportive of their kids, they may have questions and concerns. So how do you help them sort things through in 2024?
We talk about, sort of, it depends a little bit on the age of the young person, but we talk about from the young person, what can they tell us about the evolution of the feelings or the identity markers. We talk a little bit about the values of the family. So does the family have really strong values about what it is to be feminine or masculine? I think that's a really important thing to know about what the family prioritizes. We talk about what social transition might look like. And so that with young people, that's really what we're talking about. We're talking about haircuts and clothes and being able to go to school feeling as much yourself as you can. School is hard for a lot of people, in lots of different ways. And then we talk about sort of some of the systemic barriers. So, how are we going to work in the extended family? How are we going to work in the faith community? How are we going to work at school? What does summer camp look like? What do sports teams look like? And so those are some of the pieces that we're really thinking about when we're thinking about children and young teens. Some of the families are, I'd say that that's the vast majority of the work. What's it like to have crushes? What's it like to have a boyfriend or girlfriend? What are some of those normal child and adolescent development markers like when you know yourself in your gender in your own way? You might be seen in one way and experience something else. So a lot of those conversations are like, what do you do when you were always on co-ed soccer teams and then you turned 10 and now the teams are gendered? I had a really neat conversation with a kid once who actually tried both teams, and their feedback was, the coaches on the girls team call you sweetheart and have low expectations of you. And on the boys team, they don't call you sweetheart, but they really expect you to win. I was like, oh, I'd like to structure a gender studies class around this 10-year-old's experience of going to soccer. Because it was just this like fascinating, expose in this one conversation. So we're talking about, what's happening for the kid. And then we're talking with the parents about, are there things that are causing them a little bit of distress? And often the things that cause us distress are, what are people going to think about me? What's my mother-in-law going to think?
Are they going to, is it my fault as a parent somehow?
Yeah. Or, it really depends on kind of the social culture around those parents. So, did we fail something? And I think, our children talking to us as parents is a win. I'm a parent of an adult person. Paula and I have Our daughters are around the same age. And, you know, that kid keeping on talking to me through our life is a win all the time. And so I think, you know, if we can create situations where our kids talk to us, where our kids tell us what's going on, and where, you know, we don't over ascribe, whatever the gender identity or the gender difference for all the problems, right? So sometimes that can become the thing that families are really focused on. And the other questions are like, well, how do we get this kid to clean their room? How do we deal with the fact that we have dinner at 6 and they're snacking at 11? Like, you know, just like we're talking about kids doing normal kid development things. Sometimes families are also thinking about looking into medical transition, not always, but sometimes at different points. And so sometimes as a social worker in clinical practice, and this would be true for a psychologist, we're starting to think about how do we support the family in finding those good resources. Sometimes we're called on to write letters of referral to help make that transition at really key points. In sort of their medical journey, where we would be saying, this is what I'm seeing in my practice. These are some of the guidelines that I would use to assess. And there are very clear guidelines that are set out. And then I would send that to a doctor who would then be doing their entirely own medical assessment.
I think that's a really important point, because I think, you know, you would think from some of the anti-trans rhetoric out there, that a kid decides on Tuesday they're trans and they have, you know, gender reassignment surgery on Friday, and that is not how anything works. But I think that's the kind of hysteria that's been promulgated about this. So, Christy, I wanted to ask you, what about the, you know, the teens you're seeing yourself, and, you know, and their peer group? What have Premier Smith's public comments meant to them and for them?
For teens, some of what I have seen is sometimes it's hard to know what is just an idea, which is what we're at right now. Some ideas have been floated with a release video by the premier, but nothing has been passed into legislation. So I've talked to young people who are surprised that their teachers are still calling them by their name, because they thought that when this announcement came, that was going to mean that suddenly their teacher was going to go back to using the name they haven't used for a really long time. Sometimes I have met young people who are very desperately afraid that they will not access healthcare until they're an adult. That their healthcare, if they're a young person who is seeking support with hormone care, either puberty blockers, which are typically prescribed by doctors at the onset of puberty, or testosterone or estrogen, which are typically prescribed late, sort of after puberty at 16 or 17, that they're really worried that they won't have access to those supports. And I think what's really important to know is that I think sometimes when we talk about trans youth, we talk about hormone changes as if they are cosmetic decisions about achieving cosmetic goals, and not that they are largely about like the hormones in the body that help the body to feel in alignment with itself. I don't know if I could explain that well, but we sort of think, people think it's about like facial hair and not about sort of like the body feeling more ease. So I think that helping people to understand that one of the changes that comes from hormone care, there's really, really good evidence, is that it reduces distress. And reducing distress for teens can be a very important way that we can support them in medical and mental health care.
Now, there are a lot of loving parents out there who wouldn't ever think of themselves as homophobes, who may be thinking, if my kid were going through something like this, I would want the school to tell me. I would want the school to tell me if they are asking to be addressed by a different pronoun or a different name. Alex, let me start with you. What would be the risks of requiring schools to notify parents as the premier has proposed?
So one of the things that, again, just the way that this has been phrased and framed really doesn't match the reality of how this is for most kids, for most parents, and most families. As Christy said before, most families that I work with are at least partially supportive. The biggest problem that we find with these announcements is that they are going to target and harm the absolutely most vulnerable. So in my previous role, I traveled all over the province. I worked with thousands of teachers throughout this province, doing workshops and professional development, working with administration, supporting GSAs, gay, straight, or gender sexuality alliances within schools. And I'll tell you, if there's kids in schools using a different name or using a different pronoun, the vast majority are not doing that without their family knowing. Most kids, their family knows, and they're talking about it. We never have teachers, we never have counselors encouraging or coercing kids to keep secrets from their families. Those of us who work in this kind of sphere, we know how critically important it is to have family support, because we better than anybody see the kids who are rejected, who don't have family support, and how hard and terrible that is. So the kids that I've met, the small minority of kids who have a different name or use a different pronoun at school that maybe their family hasn't been told about yet, I've never met one who was happy about that. I have never once met one of those kids who's like, I know my parents would be fine with this, but I just like to keep secrets. Or, you know, it's never trivial. These kids are gutted. They are absolutely broken up about not being able to tell their family, because they're the ones sitting at the dinner table who hear homophobic and transphobic jokes or slurs or comments that really strongly indicate to them that it wouldn't be safe. So for those kids who are out at home and out at school, or have at least some general understanding of their family, that they're, you know, trying different names to see like what feels right to them as they go through that natural maturation and growth process, that it isn't necessarily going to affect them as much directly. I think there's going to be an indirect creation of this kind of climate of transphobia, which is already there, and encourage that. But the kids who are going to be harmed the absolute most are those kids who are utilizing school as the only place in their life that gives them some safety.
One thing is to add what Alex said. I meet a lot of young people who actually have tried to tell their parents, who've tried to float some information at home, and they've done the trial balloon and it did not float. And so they presented some information about themselves, and they were told they were wrong. And so I think that, like, this idea that parents might be entirely surprised, I suppose there could be those examples, but there also are examples where young people have actually tried already, and it hasn't gone over well. You know, when I think about teachers, they often know that there are sometimes our dynamics in families that are really, really challenging for kids. And so the idea that they would, that they couldn't just address a kid by the name that they want to go by, kids go by different names for a lot of different reasons. And so the idea that that would be something that parents would decide instead of kids feels like a strange interjection, you know, where a kid might just want to go by something at school because nobody learned how to pronounce their name, because their name isn't in alignment with who they are, you know, for so many different reasons. There are families that are where children are unsafe. And there is really clear evidence that in families where somebody's allowed to hurt other people, a parent or an older child is allowed to hurt other people in the rules of the family, and there's a gender nonconforming child, a child who is more feminine or more masculine than the family was expecting, there is really, really clear evidence that those children are more at risk when those two dynamics come together. And often I think teachers are trying to keep kids connected. They're trying to keep them coming to school. They're trying to keep them opening up at school. And they're trying to make seeing the counselor or accessing the breakfast program or whatever other ways we can engage with young people, they're trying to make that happen. And I would hate to see any barrier to that coming up that's going to get in the way of that relationship building between the school environment, which is a place of can be such a place of safety for youth who don't have safety at home.
Yeah. So naming pronouns was a big part of the premier's announcement, but she also suggested that she will bring in a whole set of rules to prevent or curtail access to gender-affirming care for teens. Now, the three of us know that a lot of this is dog whistling and political game playing, because some of the things the premier says she wants to ban don't actually even happen in Alberta anyway. And other things, well, I'm sure there are people listening to this who may think that waiting until you're 18 to make such profound decisions about your body is a reasonable limitation. And Alex, they may say, you know, look at your example. You waited until you were an adult before you made such dramatic decisions. So I want to, again, ask each of you, I mean, Christy touched on this a bit earlier, but what would happen to teens and their families and to their doctors and other healthcare providers if Premier Smith actually goes through with her all of her proposals?
Yeah, I guess I could go first. So again, just one of the really sad things is just like how this really frames the narrative around transness in a medical way. When, as Christy said before, the vast majority of youth may not undergo a medical transition. This is targeting the absolutely most vulnerable of those youth. So a lot of youth, a lot of adults, most trans people don't undergo a medical transition as people expect or think about it. A social transition is the biggest like capacity of that. It's just how you exist in the world. Now, for those who feel like a really strong incongruence with their body, or feel like you know, a medical transition will make them feel more whole or comfortable, as Christy said, or will give them more safety, is a big thing as well, particularly helping them to exist in the world without being noted as trans, when that can be dangerous for them. All of those pieces, this is only going to target those folks in a lot of ways. And so again, the fact that it's framing transness as this kind of medical piece is really unfortunate, because again, it's only affecting those who need that medical piece for their most safety. And just again, the just untruths. I don't know. I want to be as kind as I can when I say the things that have been said by the premier about like how this is working or what it looks like is just really, really unfortunate, because there's so much that is already done to support kids and to making sure that this is safe for them. I think right now, for the places in Alberta where youth can get support, the wait list is like 3-4 years generally. So these are not momentary decisions. These are not happening without, you know, a lot of safeguards in place, with a lot of support for these youth as much as possible. These are only happening to youth who have parental support. No kid is going by themselves. No 12-year-old goes to the doctor by themselves and gets you know, any sort of surgery or anything like that whatsoever. It just kind of implies those things without directly saying them, and doesn't really delineate what the actual process looks like, which I think a lot more people would be comfortable with if the premier were honest about how things are actually happening at the moment.
All right, let's move on to one of the premier's other suggestions, which is to prevent trans kids and trans adults from playing on sports teams and segregating them onto all trans teams or in all trans leagues. Now, strikes me that it might be hard to mount a whole roster or a league of, I mean, because despite what people seem to think, there are not tens of thousands of people who are trans in this province. So, I mean, this is obviously like sort of the least important in some ways, but it just drives me, I think, the craziest of all of them, because it just seems so petty. You know, we're not talking about Olympians. We're talking about community soccer teams and ringette and curling and who knows what else. I mean, I don't know. Christy, I'll start with you, because I'm just going spluttering now. What do you think of this?
I mean, I think it's fascinating to learn that the province thinks it regulates who joins sports teams. When this came, I called a acquaintance who's a lawyer for the government, and I said, what ministry would this even be? And she said, what? And I was like, what ministry would decide who gets to join sports? And we just had one of those conversations where, you know, only one of you has read the news story, you know? It was like, what? So like, let's start with, that's not the province's role. Like, you know, in a province that wants to reduce red tape, cool example. But also, I would say, aren't we all, like, don't we want people to be involved in moving our bodies in healthful and joyful ways? I am a cis woman who is not endangered or inconvenienced or made my experience less pleasant by playing sports with other women. What a joy to get to be a person who gets to move my body in joyful ways with other people. And this creating this false idea, I mean, that's my biggest idea is if you want to do something about like the safety, I'm using air quotes, of women in sport, tackle abusive coaching, tackle the diet industry, you know, tackle uneven funding for sport. Those are some systemic things that at a governmental level we could look at. Women are not at risk from other women.
Yeah, this is something I've actually done a lot of work on. I think, you know, prior to this, I did with my colleague and friend Evan, we did a presentation for the Canadian Human Rights Conference on trans inclusion in sports quite a bit before this came up, because early on, we saw this as a very particular wedge issue. And some of the earliest kind of attacks on trans people, the two kind of bifurcated at the start. Like once trans rights kind of started to come to a head, as the backlash was coming on, we saw it kind of testing out different things to see what would be most effective, what would be easiest to get people on board and basically against trans rights. Bathroom bills were one of the earlier ones that they tried out in a number of places. It just didn't work. People just didn't resonate with that one. Sports and kids, those are the ones that resonated with your average person. And we see that continuously and continuing on until now. So the part of the reason that, you know, I think this was included in this piece is because it is something that is so polarizing for your average person who doesn't have an understanding of this topic. It's very easy to paint it in a way that, you know, even among folks who are, you know, generally supportive of trans people, it's easy to kind of radicalize on this topic or get them to say, like, I support trans, except for this. This is the one that I don't think it should. So I think it's just basically focus testing that has led to this. And part of that is, as we see the ongoing attacks on trans people, this is one of their like key points. And again, one of the things that was just so illuminating for these policies that just, we all knew it who work in this, but we're so sad to see the truth of it. I'm not sure if you saw on, I think it was February 19th, the premier was doing a press piece and somebody asked her about the trans sports piece. I have the video. I've actually included this in a presentation I've done recently where she talks about how, well, I recently saw a video doing the rounds on the internet of a rugby player and a trans rugby player who just picked up and threw down a non-trans female athlete. And it just illuminated how dangerous it is for trans people to play with non-trans people. Now, the sad part about, as soon as I heard her say that, I knew exactly which video she was talking about, because we see it constantly in anti-trans kind of homophobic and transphobic media places. And it's a video of Joanne Lagona, who is a rugby player who is not transgender, who is just a masculine woman, but is often put on TikTok with like really transphobic notes on it because she just looks fairly masculine. She is a woman who's quite butch and talking about the dangers of trans people. And hearing that was just so just deflating to know that our premier is making these rules based off of TikToks made by transphobes to hurt trans people.
And so here's an interesting visual for a podcast. I am maybe three times the size of Alex. Like I would displace way more water in the pool than Alex does. And so what an interesting idea, this sexist, I'm happy to mention that, right? And so why would we have this idea? Like that there's these sexist undertones, right, that come a part of this that say that trans women are not women is one of the things that's sort of written into this proposed legislation, and that it just creates this unfair thing. Actually, sports is not a lot about fairness. If you had me run against almost anybody, I would not win. I'm not a runner, you know? And so like, there's lots of things in sport that are about height, that are about arm length, wingspan, you know, so conditioning, how much money you had to train, right? There's so many different conditions. So why this one? The other thing is that in places where limits have been put on trans women competing, what has ended up happening is, so I think people don't think about like, how would we figure that out? What mostly has happened is that there has been genital checking and chromosomal testing of women athletes. This has largely impacted Black women who are competing, and yeah, it has largely impacted cisgender women who are tall, who are very, very athletic, or who are gender non-conforming.
Yeah, this is going to hurt way more cisgendered women than transgender women, because there is more to start off with. And yeah, like how do you check this? In Canada, you are legally allowed to change your birth certificate. I do not have male on my birth certificate. So what possible way can they ever implement this that doesn't come down to eventually requiring women to have, and this isn't a hypothetical, there are states where you have to have, you can be, if you are challenged, they can require girls to have a genital inspection. And how utterly dehumanizing and awful is that?
You know, there's the sexual abuse that people are fretting about, and it's on the other side. So, okay, so this is a question. Maybe this isn't a fair question, but I've been asking questions for a long time. I can ask some unfair ones too. This is Alberta Unbound. The premise of this podcast is to deconstruct Alberta identity in some way. Christy, I'll start with you. Let's expand your scope of practice and put the entire province on the collective couch. Do you think there is something about trans issues in Alberta in particular that make this such good politics to play in this province?
You know, I think there's a few different dynamics. Alberta has a real urban-rural divide. And there are things that are more common and more accepted in the city that are in the cities, that are more controversial and less seen in rural areas. And sadly, what this means is that many young queer and trans people grow up with the message that when they finish high school, their job is to leave home. This is something that I hear. I work with organizations across the province, do some consulting and training work, and I hear that all the time, that young people grow up and they feel like it is their job to leave. It is not their job to look for a future, to want to one day be the mayor of their town. It is their job to plan their exit and to rarely visit and to watch their back. And so I think that that is a part of what's happening, is that it's much more common in the cities to know someone who's trans or who's queer than it is in rural area, in some of our rural communities. So I think that that's part of the dynamic. You know, when human rights protection based on gender expression and gender identity was passed in Alberta in 2017, it was passed unanimously in the legislature. And that was exciting. And that, you know, that's my Alberta. My Alberta is one where people get, where we like let people be individuals, where we let people have their triumphant story, where we let people start something new. And it feels so confusing in some ways to see beloved people demonized and treated as if they are some kind of evil outside force. So I feel like this is a confusing thing about Alberta, is that we say that we want individualism. We say that we want people to make their mark. And then we back people who attack people for being authentic.
Alex?
Yeah, it's so difficult. I would say one of the things I'd like to talk about is just like that rural-urban divide. To see that, again, weaponized is so difficult. I love small town Alberta. I was born and raised in small town Alberta. And I think the narratives that are being built are done so because the attack on trans people is just such a perfect wedge issue. It's such a small community that you're unlikely to know somebody who's a member of this community very closely. And so it's very easy to build that story, that narrative about how this is a group that is, you know, bad. Like, well, let's just put it that way. Like, the way that this is framed is that this is a problem community. And so the premier can attack this community, which will really energize that very, very tiny group of people, I think, who are actively transphobic or actively maliciously transphobic. It's incredibly energizing to them, and they form like a very core part of a base. And then through creating a narrative that can affect a little bit more low-key a huge segment of the population who doesn't know enough about this topic and doesn't really have enough interest in this topic, that will just be generally influenced, be like, oh, well, they wouldn't do it if there wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
Kind of sense.
I've been to a couple protests in Edmonton. I went to one in Ottawa. I mean, there were people. There was, I think, a bigger one in Calgary, but I'm not seeing the kind of protests I was expecting. Where is the backlash to the backlash? Do you think there's been a fracturing of the old, you know, sort of gay rights coalition? Are people just suffering from political fatigue after, you know, people took to the streets for Black Lives Matter in Alberta? They took to the streets when, you know, when there were discoveries of graves at residential schools. I don't see that anger on the streets about this. Is the anti-trans media campaign just too effective? Or are people just wrung out?
I mean, I don't entirely share your perspective about small protests. I've seen some really exciting coalition building, you know, where, you know, choirs are coming together and leading singing protests at the ledge.
That was lovely. The singing in Churchill Square was
pretty great.
Pretty great.
Yeah, and I've seen new leaders emerging and new coalitions growing. There's in Edmonton some strong coalitions around the sport piece and trans athletes. There are some really exciting young new voices coming to the fore. I think that's really wonderful. But the people who I'm looking for and not seeing are the progressive, the sort of, I'm using air quotes, progressives, including, you know, the progressive conservatives. I'd like to know where the center is in this. You know,
yeah.
I think I'd like to see those people showing up and using their voices and connections. You know, some of the people who led gay rights protests don't see this as their issue, and that's sad. I think that, you know, there is a certain amount of, I got through the door, I got my rights, and I'm not doing the labor for the group that's being targeted today. I think that's shameful. I think that I think that we, as people who have benefited from earlier access to rights, need to be showing up for our siblings and supporting the young people in our communities. Those are the people I want to see showing up. But I also want to name that right now we're in a media world where we get our news from social media, where you can't post a newspaper article if there's a newspaper article that exists. So there's also a difference in those 30 years, right, of, you know, not having mainstream media. You know, it used to be you could count on Paula Simons to write a good column about it. And I, you know, she's not doing that big anymore. So I think that that's also a difference, is that people get their news through social media, and social media is an algorithm that feeds us what it thinks we want to hear. And that's a real obstacle to organizing.
And Alex, I will give you the last word.
I would say I agree with Chrissy. Like, I think there has been some things going on that, you know, are really encouraging. I was part of that singing protest, which was just beautiful and lovely and wonderful. Like the weekend after the announcement, we had like some really great protests happening there as well. So there are things happening. You're right. It isn't as groundswell as some previous ones, but a big part of it is the way that it's being framed. Part of the, you know, benefit of targeting such a small community is that it's a smaller community. It's a lot easier for people to think this isn't a problem that affects them. And it's a lot easier for people to kind of like take that distance. It's a community that, just due to such historical stigma and marginalization, some folks are just uncomfortable being seen associated with this community. A lot of people feel uncomfortable with, you know, marching with trans people and a big trans flag in that way, even if they're like ostensibly for trans rights. This is going to hurt everybody.
And that was my conversation with Alex Marshall, Strategic Initiatives Officer for the University of Alberta's College of Health Science, and Christy Harcourt, social worker, therapist,
and faculty member of the McEwen University School of Social Work. Alberta Unbound is produced and edited by Caitlin Cummings and written and presented by me, Alberta Independent Senator Paula Simons. If you enjoyed this conversation, you might also enjoy the episode we called One Just Transition, where I spoke with Edmonton trans activist Marnie Panis, or the one we call A Royal Progress, where I interviewed Edmonton queer historian, playwright, and drag queen Darren Hogan. If you enjoy Alberta Unbound, please like and subscribe, leave a review, share a link, tell a friend. Keep the conversation going. But most of all, thank you for listening. Merci, and hi.